quite a bit has happened since I was here last week. Firstly, the governor, Zerubbabel, and the priest, the high priest, Joshua, have passed on. So also have the two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. A couple of generations have turned over, and the people, without that strong leadership, have started to drift away from God and fallen into bad habits. Added to that, the king, Darius, that we've spoken of in the first two talks, he also has died, and he was followed by a king called Ahasuerus. That's the man you read about in the book of Esther. But after reigning for about 20 years, he also died, and the present king is a man called Artaxerxes. Now, Artaxerxes came to the throne of Persia in 465 BC, and in the seventh year of his reign, that is 458 BC, the man Ezra went to him and got permission to go back to Jerusalem and help to reform the people. So if you do a little bit of mental arithmetic here, you'll find that between the end of chapter 6 and the beginning of chapter 7, there's a gap of approximately 60 years. Last week we finished off in the end of chapter 6, where the temple was completed. And the date is very easy to ascertain from the data given to us. It was 516 BC. And then in chapter 7, we now come to the era of Ezra himself. Ezra was not even born at the time the temple was built. But as I say, a couple of generations have turned over, approximately 60 years. The former leaders have all passed on. A couple of kings have come and gone. And now we have this godly man, Ezra. Ezra was a priest and a scribe. First of all, a scribe. In the ancient times, as you know, they had no printing presses, and if you wanted a copy of the law, you had to get a scribe to write it out. And during the time that the people were in captivity in Babylon, and then later on, of course, under Persia, the teaching of the law became very prominent in Israel. Because in captivity, they didn't have the opportunity to offer sacrifices, and so great emphasis was placed on teaching the moral precepts of the law. Because of this demand for the law, you find that scribes started to rise in prominence in Israel, so much so that they became looked upon as people skilled in the law, because they had to write it out and devote great attention to the details of the law. And as a result, these scribes became the people who ordinary people went to if they had a problem. Now, originally, the priests should have been the teachers in Israel, but you find now that the scribes become very prominent, and Ezra is both a priest and a scribe. Now, unfortunately, many of the people that came after Ezra over the next 400 years were not godly people of the caliber of Ezra, and when you get to the New Testament, these scribes are something of a nuisance in the Israelite religion. When you read the Gospels, you do very clearly get the impression that the scribes are now the chief men in the religious system of Israel, not the priests. The scribes are known as teachers of the law, or lawyers, or rabbis. Ezra was a scribe, one of the better type back in the era we're looking at here, and he was also a priest. He was concerned that since the former leaders had died off in Israel and people had grown up without a knowledge of God's law, various wrong practices had crept in. He was concerned about this, and he decided he would like to do something to bring people back to a knowledge of the law of God. So he went to the Persian governor. Ezra himself lived in Persia. He went to the governor and he got permission. And he also got some money in order to carry out the reforms that he wanted to introduce into Jerusalem. So that's the point now we pick up the story at in chapter 7. And as we read through just a few selected verses, you'll find reference to the things that I've just mentioned in outline. Now chapter 7, first verse tells us that Artaxerxes is the king of Persia, and Ezra is the man we're speaking of. You come down to verse 6. Ezra went up from Babylonia, which of course is now Persia. He was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses. Notice that again. A scribe skilled in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. And the king granted him all that he asked, for the hand of the Lord his God was upon him. Verse 7. There went also up to Jerusalem in the seventh year, that's the seventh year, the note I gave you before, various other people. Come down to verse 10. Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel. And for all preachers, teachers, Sunday school teachers, youth leaders, church leaders, parents, any of us who are in any position where we're telling people what to do or teaching people, let us take a cue here from verse 10. A very good example. Ezra, he first of all set his heart to study the law. Now that's point one. You've got to study the thing first. But then you have to do it, and then you teach it. And I think the sequence is correct. The sequence that Ezra followed is the sequence we should follow. We must understand it, and then we must practice it, and then we have the right to teach it. This is a copy in verse 11 of the letter which King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest and the scribe. Notice in verse 11 the two things mentioned together, priest and scribe, a man learned in matters of the commandments of the Lord. Verse 12 gives the introduction, Artaxerxes, the usual introduction there. In verse 13, Artaxerxes says, I make a decree that any one of the people of Israel or their priests or Levites in my kingdom who freely offers to go to Jerusalem may go with you, Ezra. For you are sent by the king and his seven counselors, that's his cabinet, his ministers, I take it, to make inquiries about Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand, and also to convey the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem. So you notice here that Ezra and his friends go back with the full support of the government. The king and his cabinet not only give them support, they give them permission to teach the law of God and to implement reforms among the wayward people of God back in Jerusalem. Not only that, but he is given a grant of money in verse 15. We've seen this previously, haven't we? Way back in the time of Zerubbabel, when he returned, he got a grant of money from the Persian rulers. And then later on, another one in the time of the following king, when the work on the construction of the temple was recommenced. And now again, they have a grant of money from the government. And not only that, but verse 21 tells us that they get extra cash from the local treasury, that is, from the funds of the local province. And if we can just give some sort of parallel here, it's not only a grant from the federal government, but it's also a grant from the state government. So there's a sort of parallel, if you can see what's happening here. In verse 15, the king in Persia gives the money, and then in verse 21 he says, I also decree that all the treasurers in the province beyond the river, that is the province in which Palestine was situated, contribute to Ezra's funds. Whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven requires of you, be it done with all diligence. So there it is. The government is really supporting Ezra, and they give a limit concerning how much they're to go to. Now Ezra had considerable power. He was, first of all, given a tax exemption. Now here again, I guess many things for Christian work today get tax exemptions. If you're buying a typewriter or something like that for use in the church, and you get a document authorized by the officials of the church, well, of course, you can get a tax exemption from the government. You don't have to pay sales tax. Now, here again, he has some sort of tax exemption. So that's not to be sneezed at, as the saying goes. He goes on to tell us that he was also given permission to set up courts, judicial courts, to try various cases where people have disobeyed God's law. Not only that, but as well as establishing courts, he had the right to lay down penalties and to carry out these judgments. Here we can see the forerunner of the Sanhedrin of later times. In fact, studying Ezra in Nehemiah is a fascinating exercise because it really gives you the origins of so many of the things that we meet in the New Testament. In our very first talk, I talked about the Samaritans, and then we talked about the scribes, and even the origins of the synagogue goes back to here, when Ezra taught the law, because the synagogue was not a temple, the synagogue was simply a preaching place, a place for fellowship and worship, much the same as our buildings here. No sacrifices or anything like that in synagogues. These things grew up during the captivity when the temple was in ruins, and then after the captivity, Ezra, Nehemiah and their friends developed the teaching of the law, and so the synagogues developed, and the scribes grew in power, and now we have the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council. We find the origins of it here, as authority is given to Ezra to police the law of God among his own people. Verse 24, we also notify you that it shall not be lawful to impose tribute, custom or toll. Okay, that's a note for the local governors. Give these chaps tax exemption. Verse 25, and as for you, Ezra, According to the wisdom of your God, which is in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges who may judge all the people in the province beyond the river or West Euphrates. All such as know the laws of your God, and those who do not know them, you shall teach. Whoever will not obey the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be strictly executed upon him, whether for death or for banishment or for confiscation of his goods or for imprisonment. Wide sweeping powers here are given to Ezra as he goes back to Jerusalem. And well might Ezra in verse 27 say, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of our fathers, who put such a thing as this into the heart of the king." God does exceedingly abundant above all that we ask or think. So Ezra now prepared to go back. But it was going to be quite a journey, because the journey from Babylon back to Palestine was across what is known as the Fertile Crescent. It's quite a long trek. They followed the Mesopotamian Valley around, and it took several months. In fact, if you read the data here, you'll find it took 4 months for Ezra and his troops to go back to Jerusalem. It was a journey that was beset with many dangers. There were robbers, bandits, all sorts of people who were only too eager to ambush these people on the way. And the king offered Ezra a guard, some mounted troops to protect them. Ezra said, "No, we've trusted in God, and we believe God will protect us. Thank you very much, but I won't take your armed guard." And so he put his faith where his mouth is, so to speak. He put his money where his mouth is. I think that's the expression, isn't it? Yes. He demonstrated his faith by saying, "I'm not going to take this guard." Now, there's an interesting point here. When you come to Nehemiah, you find that Nehemiah did take a guard with him. He had the same offer made to him about 13 years later when he went back, and he did take the armed guard. It's an interesting point, isn't it? Because that's the freedom that we have. I'm not saying that Ezra was right and Nehemiah was wrong, or that Nehemiah was right and Ezra was wrong. We have great freedom, and different people see things in different ways. Some people prefer to act in blind faith, and some people feel that they'd be quite happy to accept. Some people might have felt they couldn't accept the money, for example, that the government offered. They might say, "No, we don't want that money." But Ezra decides he will take the money. But then Ezra decides he won't take the guard. But somebody else says, "We will take the guard." This is the sort of freedom, of course, that we exercise, because we're all different types of people. Some people feel free, let us say Christian workers, some people feel free to take a set salary, nothing wrong with that. Other people feel they'd rather not do that. They want a different system of support, which is rather less regulated. I don't think any one of them is right or wrong in itself. And we have this freedom again to weigh up whatever the situation is and to make our own decision on it. And so Ezra makes this decision, Nehemiah makes a different decision. As far as I can see, the writers of the Bible report both as having God's approval. Verse 21 of chapter 8 talks about what I've just been talking about. Before he came to push off from where he was pushing off from, he had a time of prayer, asking for God's protection, and he declared a fast in verse 21 at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him a straight way for ourselves, our children, and our goods. For I was ashamed to ask the king for a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy on our way, since we had told the king, "The hand of our God is for good upon all that seek him, and the power of his wrath is against those who forsake him." So we fasted, and we besought our God for this, and he listened to our entreaty. And now once again, just to show that his faith was not so many words, it goes on to tell us that he took an account of all the money and goods that they had. They drew up a list. And his idea was that when he got to the other end in Jerusalem, they could check through the list and find that every shekel was still there. He's not only saying, "I've got faith," but he's demonstrating his faith. And a lot of us say, "We believe this, we believe that." But when it comes to putting it into practice, quite often we find that we're not quite as clever as we said we were. Ezra has said, "God will protect us. I'm staking my faith on God, and just to prove it, let's make a list of everything in our possession, and in 4 months' time at the other end, we'll check through the list, and we'll see if anything's missing." So in verse 24, he set apart 12 of the leading princes, And in verse 25, he weighed out to them the silver, the gold, the vessels, and all the other things. And then it gives the details of how much was there in the following verses. In verse 31, they departed from the river Ahava on the 12th day of the first month. The hand of God was upon them, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes on the way. And we came to Jerusalem in verse 32. And you read in verse 33 that they weighed out all the goods and the money. They checked it according to the list. In verse 34, the whole was counted and weighed, and the weight of everything was recorded, illustrating that nothing was lost. The whole lot was there, and not only did they get there safely, but it of course vindicated the faith of Ezra, and his faith was rewarded, you might say, through the safe journey. They then made offerings in verse 35 on behalf of the whole of Israel. In verse 36, they then presented their credentials to the local governors. They delivered the king's commissions to the king's satraps and to the governors of the province beyond the river. And now, of course, they are free to go ahead and do the things Ezra wants to do. Well, Ezra wasn't back there very long before he found that there were some things badly astray. And the main issue, which takes up the remainder of the book, chapters 9 and 10, concerns mixed marriages, by which we mean that the people of Israel had married some of the non-Israelite people round about. Now, that in itself may not be any great crime. It's not a racist law, rather it's a law to protect the purity of the religion. And the law, if you look at it in detail, was not simply that they were not to marry non-Jewish people, rather it was that they were not to marry heathen people. And there is a difference, of course, because there could have been believers among the non-Jewish people, but it was the heathen people, the non-Jewish people, who were not believers. Means 99.9% of them, in other words. They married these people, and then we have a mixture of these religions. And so the idolatry and the false religion, which had been the cause of Israel's downfall many centuries earlier and the reason for the nation's destruction, it's starting to rear its ugly head again. And immediately these men, Ezra and Nehemiah, come in and they squash it very quickly because they want to stamp out idolatry. Part of the reason for the captivity was to get rid of idolatry from Israel. And as soon as it rears its ugly head, these leaders come down heavily upon it. And they were successful, because as you read the later history of Israel and come into the New Testament, you find that idolatry has indeed disappeared from Israel, and no longer was it to be a bother. They had other problems instead, but at least idolatry was gone. When Ezra sees this frightful state of affairs, he leads the nation in repentance, and it's a magnificent prayer. You get another couple of prayers of Ezra's in the book of Nehemiah, because you find later on that Nehemiah came back, and then the two, Ezra and Nehemiah, cooperated in further reforms. Some of the great prayers of the Old Testament, the prayers of Moses, the prayers of Samuel, the prayers of Daniel, the prayers of Ezra, marvelous prayers. We haven't time to read them all through, but I'm sure that if you just get a taste of them, you can enter into the spirit of these prayers, and I hope that you can help make them your own. Over the years, I've made a practice of studying the prayers of the Bible, memorizing quite a lot of them, and then basing my own prayers around those prayers. And I can assure you, it does lift you above the mundane, trifling little things that sometimes we get bogged down in. Just look here at a few things in this prayer. In chapter 9, for example, verse 6. He says, O my God, I am ashamed and I blush to lift my face to thee, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads and our guilt has mounted up to the heavens. And he goes on in this strain. Verse 8. Now for a brief moment, now in this captivity, they've returned from captivity and they have this permission from the Persians to rebuild their temple and reconstruct the nation. Now for this brief moment, favor has been shown by the Lord our God to leave us a remnant, a faithful minority of the people, and to give us a secure hold within his holy place, that our God may brighten our eyes and grant us a little reviving in our bondage. For we are bondmen, yet our God has not forsaken us in our bondage, but has extended to us his steadfast love before the kings of Persia, to grant us some reviving, to set up the house of our God, to repair its ruins, and to give us protection in Judea and Jerusalem. Oh, the marvelous love and the grace of God. But how often we take it for granted. And now, verse 10, O our God, what shall we say to this? Because we have forsaken thy commandments. And he goes on then to detail how the people have departed from God. We are remarkably callous at times. When we're in great strife, we cry to God and we ask for his help. And as soon as we're going along quite smoothly, God seems to recede into the background again, and we forget his great and mighty love. And we've forsaken his commandments. We forget to be diligent in our prayer, in our living for God, in our study of God's word, in our spiritual exercises. We become slack. And that's what's happened here. In verse 13, he says, after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, seeing that thou, O Lord, hast punished us less than our iniquities deserve. That's interesting, isn't it? He's not fighting or shaking his fist in the face of God and saying, God's not fair, God punishes us all the time and nobody else seems to get punished, but we, God's people, seem to get the problems all the time. No, there's nothing of that. He realizes, as we should realize, that any chastisement, any punishment we do get, when it's all boiled down, is an awful lot less than we really deserve. God is a marvelous God of grace. You have punished us, he says, less than our iniquities deserve, and you've given us such a remnant as this. Now therefore, verse 14, shall we break thy commandments again and intermarry with the peoples who practice these abominations? Now there's the root of the problem, intermarrying not simply with people of another race, but intermarrying with people who practice these abominations, people who don't know God and who have all these idolatrous religions. Verse 15, O Lord, the God of Israel, thou art just. No attempt to defend himself. God is just, and any difficulties we run into, any punishments, are fitting. In fact, they are less than we really deserve. Thou art just, O God. Well, verse 10, while Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him out of Israel, and the people wept bitterly. They repented, and they supported Ezra in what he had just said. However, Ezra pretty soon found that the problem was so widespread that it wasn't going to be fixed overnight. He didn't quite know what to do. And he did something very sensible, which I would say is a very good lesson for us in verse 6. He spent a night in prayer with God. He made haste slowly. He didn't walk in and say, okay, let's roll up the sleeve and get stuck into this problem. Let's form a committee and we'll appoint this and this and this. No. He realized there was a problem. It had to be tackled. But first of all, he spent time in prayer seeking God's will. In verse 6, he withdrew from before the house of God and he went to the chamber of a person here where he spent the night, neither eating bread nor drinking water, for he was mourning over the faithlessness of the exiles. As he wept and humbled himself before God and sought God's face, then we find after that he called a meeting in verse 7. And in verse 9, the men of Judah and Benjamin, that is the people who'd returned from exile, they came to Jerusalem within 3 days. They sat in the open square, we find later on, and they trembled because of this matter and also because of the heavy rain, which is just something that causes us to smile a little. They were shaking with fear because of the wrong things they had done, but also shivering a bit because they were cold sitting out in the rain. But they were genuine in their repentance. And in verse 12, they answer with a loud voice and they admit they're wrong. Once again, you see, they admit they're wrong. They say, it is so. We have done wrong. We must do as you've said. Verse 13, but the people are many and it's a time of heavy rain. We can't stand out here in the open all the time, they said, nor is this a work for one day or even for two. We have greatly transgressed in this matter. So let officials be appointed. And so it goes on to say that the way God was going to handle this, or the way Ezra was going to handle it on God's behalf, was to appoint officials, and then it goes on to talk about who the officials were, and to entrust this work to them so that they could look out the various people who had wronged God in this way, and then they could put the matter right. So in verse 16, they selected various men, and if you read it through, checking out the dates in verses 16 and 17, you find that it took them 3 months to sort the problem out. The problems that we create among God's people cannot always be fixed overnight. And we must be patient, both the leaders and the people must be patient, seeking God's will, and having sought God's will, then putting it into practice by appointing people who are gifted and suitable to carry out the duty. And then the final part of chapter 10, which is full of names, gives the lists of those who had sinned. And the point I draw your attention to is that the people at the head of the list were none other than the sons of the priests in verse 18. The very people who were supposed to teach the law of God, supposed to be the spiritual leaders in Israel, they come at the top of the list when the wrongdoers are mentioned. The prices of leadership are high. Paul develops this in the letter to Timothy, where he says those who sin among the leaders, that is, those who are guilty, he says, rebuke before all, because their position of leadership means that they are more open to criticism, and of course any bad example or wrongdoing is obviously going to have a greater effect upon the congregation of God's people than if it had been committed by some less prominent person. The rewards of leadership, you might say, are great, and the prestige is there, but the price also is there. Our politicians, of course, find that likewise, don't they? It's great to be at the top, but the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And so the prices of leadership are indeed high. Well, the sons of the prophets are singled out first. Verse 23, next in line come the Levites. As you move down the list, they're all listed, names spelt out for everybody to see. And then verse 25 to the end, all the rank and file of Israel. And we don't know exactly how the problem was solved. The mechanics of it aren't spelt out for us, but there you have the outline of what happened, how Ezra carried on this initial work of reform in bringing people back to the knowledge of God. And the point is, they were cooperating. They were responsive. God's people will be able to put things right and will be able to see the work of God moving ahead when you get this sort of cooperation. When the leaders take the lead and the people give their cooperation, then we can look forward, I believe, to the sort of blessing that Israel experienced under the leadership of this godly man, Ezra.